right?
From the campus of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to WSSU Future Focus. Everything Winston-Salem State University. And now your host, WSSU Chancellor Elwood Robinson.
Tell me a little bit about your work. You've been in Guilford County. You've been CEO in terms of since 2013 and thereabout. Tell us a little bit about how you happened to come into this role after coming from corporate America and doing some amazing work. Now you're a CEO at United Way. Tell us about that transition.
Yeah, so the reality is I loved my corporate role. And sometimes you have to know when to hang up your heels, as I like to say. And I needed to do a transition. I was traveling quite a bit, to be perfectly honest with you. And I was traveling internationally. And I really just looked at the dynamics of my life. And my children were 5 and 10 at the time. And I said, something's got to give. And the reality was I was a road warrior. I was an extraordinary employee, but I wasn't doing the right thing as it relates to how I wanted to contribute to my children's lives and my personal life. So I hung up my heels and decided I was going to learn the community. I left New York City and came to Greensboro. And so I needed to learn what was going on in Greensboro. And as I went on my exploration, I realized that there was a tale of two cities. And that we had some systemic issues that were causing people to live in entrenched poverty. And United Way board, I was on their board at the time, and I also had my own consulting firm. And they said, hey, please resign from our board and become a consultant and help us rethink how we do business. And the rest, as they say, is her story. So that's where it started.
Right. And you come into this position and the work that you do, we'll talk a little bit about the work, but the work is personal for you.
Yes, it is.
And why is it personal for you?
You know, I came from very humble beginnings. My family grew up in sharecropping, agrarian South Carolina, and moved to New York City in the Great Migration from the South. And I lived in public housing on the Lower East Side. And from those humble beginnings, I understand generational poverty. I understand breaking the cycle. And I understand what it takes. And it does take a village. It takes a community. And we were very blessed that there was a community to lift our family up. And that community, if you will, is also present here in North Carolina, in the Triad area. And TAG, we are the community. And so how is it we take our resources and pool them to help people? Because that's what United Way is about, caring people, pooling their resources to help others. And at the end of the day, I know what's possible. So I come to the work with a set of principles and a strategic focus. And we are marching and we are really making inroads and we can see the impact.
Absolutely, and we see it every day. Michelle, you're one of the few people that I've seen that you have the courage to talk about poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes courage to do that. A lot of people shy away from that. You talk about it, you're unapologetic about it. You want people to know about it and you want to do something about it.
That's right. There is no problem that has ever been solved that we don't talk about. If you do not talk about the problem, you will not solve it. So the first thing we believe is we've got to educate. And most of all, we've got to help people understand their privilege, because there is nothing wrong with privilege, because I submit to you that the two of us are privileged. And it's not privilege equally, but it is privilege. Privilege becomes a problem when you oppress others. And so it's really important as we come to this work that we have conversations and we have become a society that calls people out. I submit to you that we have an opportunity to call people in. Mm. So we come to our work calling people in. and having rich conversations and assessing what everybody brings to the table. Because everybody brings something to the table, including people in poverty. They bring something to the table. So we set the table for everyone's voice to be heard and for us to come up with the right strategies.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a book that's I'm never too far from, Michelle, is a book by Jeffrey Sachs, and it's called The End of Poverty. Mm. And the reason I'm never too far from this is you talked about growing up in South Carolina. I grew up in rural North Carolina. I mean, you talk about poverty, that's how I grew up. But if we think about the lost potential,
yes,
and what poverty creates in so many of our rural areas in North Carolina and across the country, and even in our urban areas as well, how that's lost talent. I started by saying, you believe that we can do something about it. Do you believe, like Jeffrey Sachs, that we can end poverty?
I do. I truly, truly do.
I am glad to hear you say that because I do as well. I do as well.
I do. Yeah. And I know it's possible. Now, when? I'm not going to be foolish enough to give you a date.
Sure.
But I can tell you how. And I can tell you what it looks like.
Hmm.
And it looks different for all of us because how you left rural North Carolina and wound up being the chancellor of a university, how I left Lower East Side public housing, major city, to become a senior vice president at American Express, very different paths. And so I don't suggest that there's one size fits all. And unfortunately, that's why poverty still exists, because we've been applying standardized process and procedures to people's lives, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. What are some of the barriers that get in the way of us lifting ourselves out of poverty?
Yeah. So I think one of the number one issues that we all must face is that poverty is a system of oppression and racism.
Hmm.
Poverty has its roots in racism, which manifests itself as low wages, mass incarceration, obesity, poor schools, lack of housing, homelessness. And what we've done for so long is we've treated the symptoms and not the root cause.
Hmm.
So we are doing this business from a root cause perspective. We often are satisfied by giving people who have low income a bag of food and saying, boy, have we done something. Well, what is that person going to do next week? We've solved nothing. So I often have a bag that I carry. And I ask people, would you like a 5-pound box or would you like this little bag? It's Thanksgiving. In 2 days, you got a family of four. You make $8 an hour. Do you want the large box or do you want this little bitty shopping bag? Which do you want, Chancellor?
I'm going to take the shopping bag because it looks like it might have something important inside. I'm going to take the shopping bag.
Right. Because you see, in the shopping bag, it starts to address the root causes of poverty. You see, when children are not in school, when those young babies are being left in cribs and mama hopes she gets back to the house on time. See, she needs structured childcare for those babies.
Hmm.
You see, you don't need that box of food. You need to figure out your eligibility for SNAP benefits and get your EBT card so that you can get your fresh groceries. You see, you need a paid adult internship to teach you how to elevate your skills. You see, in my little shopping bag, I'm going to give you health insurance. In my shopping bag, you're going to get a career coach. Coaching is not just for athletes making millions of dollars. Sometimes some of us need a coach. And see, you give your students coaches so that they can be ready for the real world. And last and certainly not least, if you are not housed, you will be in poverty. It's a statistical fact. If you are not housed, you cannot get out of poverty. And so often we believe in charity. And ending poverty is not about charity. It's about system change. It's about realizing that you've got to bundle the services and supports, and you've got to talk to the system and break down the barriers of the system that actually does not have enough slots for every child in America to go to early childhood development. And you know, Chancellor, of all people, what those first 2,000 days mean.
That's right. Yeah. Look, I'm all in. I'm getting carried away just listening to you as you lay this out. Michelle, I am curious, and you started and you said systemic racism, and you said that. I'm curious as to whether your message today is different than it was even a year ago, given what has happened in this country and given how people are now paying attention to some of this. Can you talk at all about that? Because yeah. I'm thinking that it's received differently today.
It is received differently. I have said the same thing, but it is now received differently. Because what we have done is we became desensitized. And I'm going to say all of us. We got desensitized to mass incarceration, and we actually got desensitized to people being killed on the streets until the pandemic caused us to be still and watch someone's life snuffed out of him by a knee on the neck. I submit to you that the knee has been on the neck of people for centuries, but we became desensitized. And we would agree, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. What's wrong with you? Chancellor Robinson made it. Why can't you? And now we know that an equity lens, we must view solutions through an equity lens. America is not equal for everyone. And I think we know that intellectually. However, we operate from a mindset of scarcity versus abundance. So we believe that if you help a certain group of people, and let's use Black people, for example, that means that white people have less. That's not true. Mm-hmm. There's enough for all of us. And I think it's really about us being very fact-based. I love data. I don't shoot from my hip. I go with the statistics, and the statistics are clear and compelling. And so people have come to the table. They're like, you know what? This makes sense, because you see, if we create a more equitable place, the economy actually booms. The That's economy right. doesn't.
Yeah. That's right.
And people does not drag.
And people forget that. I mean, one of the amazing things about lifting everyone up is everyone wins.
Everyone wins. Right. And it has always been that way. But we lost our way. We lost our way. But I am so excited because people from all socioeconomic backgrounds, races, levels of intellect, levels of knowledge, levels of caring are sitting at the table, and we are all willing to learn from each other. Because the one thing I don't want to say tonight is that I know it all.
Right.
I don't. I have room for learning, and I don't consider myself a teacher. I consider myself a sharer of knowledge so that we might go through this journey together, because I do know that poverty may not end in my lifetime. But here's what I know. If I don't do this work today, it will grow.
Right.
It will grow.
And so listening to you, it sounds like you are encouraged by the shift in discourse around things like structural racism, diversity and inclusion. People are now speaking differently about it, asking for help and understanding. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're encouraged by that, discourse.
I really am. I'm not naive.
Right, sure.
But I am encouraged.
Yep. Great. Tell us a little bit about the area, your city, Greensboro, kinds of things you're working on. What are some of the big ticket items for United Way of Greater Greensboro?
Yeah, so we are applying some theories that are evidence-based. If you think about Bryan Stevenson has been talking about mass incarceration and entrenching poverty for a long time. And one of the principles of Bryan Stevenson's work is being proximate to the problem. But often, if there's a leaky roof and the roofer can't come till tomorrow and the leak is in the house, we don't put the bucket under the leak. We take the bucket and take it down the street.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing in the sector as we think about addressing generational poverty. So what we've said at United Way of Greater Greensboro is we said we're going to stop the madness. Because the definition of insanity for us is teaching a kid how to read and sending him home to chaos. We also believe that giving a mother a job, knowing she has young children with no childcare, is another definition of chaos. So what we've said is our work must be too generational. Our work must have an equity lens. Our work must be place-based. We have to do our work in the neighborhood. And that we have to stay with people for the long haul. It's not get a job and goodbye. It's get a job, get promoted, stay on the job, and continue to advance and gather skills so that you become the person that you want to be and reach your full potential and not who I want to be and not what society views as a fix. So what we've done is we've opened something called Family Success Centers, which are about integrated service delivery. And it tells us that if you bundle and sequence supports for someone in a place, so for example, how many GED programs do you think there are in Greensboro that have childcare in the same building? Guess how many?
Four.
One.
One.
At United Way of Greater Greensboro's Family Success Center.
Well, good for you. Good. Right? That's great. That's great.
So when we think about it, right, and not to put the college on the hot seat.
Wait a minute, but you are. No, wait.
22% of undergraduate people are parents. 22% of people going to undergraduate school in America right now are parents. Do we think that 22% of the colleges and universities have childcare on campus to make that climb a little easier? Don't answer. But that's the kind of conversation that we can have, right? So how can United Way help you put a 5-star childcare center on campus? Because your students are parents.
Right.
They are, right? 22%. And that wasn't the case when we went to college, Chancellor. But it is the case now.
Yeah.
And we haven't changed the system. And so that's one of the systems that cause people not to finish, to have a college loan but never finish. And their earning potential is decreased. So we're just going in and we're just asking these kinds of questions and saying to families, what do you need? What are your goals and aspirations for you and your children? And it has to be at the household level, because the way the two of us got out of poverty, Chancellor, is that the household was rooting for each other. And it doesn't matter who's in the household. It matters that we're rooting for each other.
I love that.
And we're just helping people root for each other.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Michelle, as leader of the United Way of Greater Greensboro, as we go into this holiday season, Thanksgiving, what are you most thankful for? And what is your hope for Greater Greensboro and the Triad communities?
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you, my faith tells me that my role at United Way is to support the fatherless, the widow, and the poor. And I come to my work truly believing that that is why I'm here on earth. That is why I transitioned from corporate America. So I am grateful that God allows me to play some small role in my corner of the world. So that is what I am personally grateful for. And I am grateful for a community that actually is willing to do something. I don't need anyone to do everything. I'm talking about families in poverty. They're willing to do something. And so for me, this is the season of sacrifice. Sacrifice to help a neighbor. Sacrifice to help a stranger. Sacrifice in some ways to help yourself. And I think the more that we do that, the better off we really, really are, because we are actually more alike than we are different. And that's across all races and all socioeconomic background. Last time I went to the cemetery, I didn't see any cars in graves. I didn't see bank accounts in graves, right? So I do think that we've got to lean on our humanity. And we've got to really figure out what matters and what can we control and figure out how to work together. So in this season, you know, I'm not about toys. Mm. I'm about, how do I help people pay rent? How do I help people keep the lights on? Because toys can come later. I'm talking about survival. So I often talk to people when they call me and say, we got some toys. I'm like, I don't want them unless they come with some help to pay utilities and to keep people from being evicted when that CDC moratorium is over. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity during this season for us to really shine a light on what it is that we can do. And the conditions that exist existed before COVID-19. This is not pandemic specific. This is about our shared humanity. So in this holiday season, I'm excited about our shared humanity. That we're going to take care of each other and that things are going to be better one day at a time.
Yeah. That's amazing. And I thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
I thank you so much for that spirit. I thank you so much for the grace, the work that you do. I tell folks every day, folks in your position, what you do every day is really God's work. I appreciate you, Michelle. Thank you for coming on Future Focus Now. We thank you for that.
Thank you for having me. Happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you. Happy Thanksgiving. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with another great guest. Don't go nowhere. We'll be back in just a moment for more Future Focus Now.
I'm really thankful and humbled by the continued generosity of our alumni and friends at Winston-Salem State University. Despite the fact that we're faced with this unprecedented global crisis, our alumni and friends continue to come forward and seek ways to support our students and the university community. So we're very thankful for each and every gift, each and every phone call. Thank you for reaching out to us, asking about ways that you can help our students, our faculty, and staff.
I am most thankful for life, safety, health, and well-being, and for family. One of the great positives out of 2020 is family time that maybe a lot of us did not have previously. And so that has been a great blessing. And as one of my team members said, thankful for the things that we don't have, which is being without food and being without a job and being without family. So thankful and blessed.
I am very thankful for my family, for good health, and for life.
I am thankful for the many influences that impact my life. For without them, I wouldn't be who I am today, especially the influences from Winston-Salem State University.
Elise Oxendine, graduate from Winston-Salem State University in 2008. For the past 12 years, Elise has dedicated her career to helping emerging independent filmmakers succeed in a tough but rewarding industry. She has achieved this primarily through her work in marketing, distribution, and strategy at New York Film Festival. Rooftop Films, and Good Deed Entertainment. Currently, she works as the Director of Industry and Festival Outreach at Columbia University's prestigious graduate film program, pulling together her experience in the industry and mentoring a new generation of writers, directors, and producers. She is an esteemed alumna of Columbia and serves on the board of directors for the Columbia Alumni Association. She's also a proud graduate of Winston-Salem State University, having double majored in English and mass communications, and is committed to serving the Black community through her position on the board for the nonprofit Black Film Space. Elise has served on several film festivals, including River Run Festival, New Orleans Film Festival, and has spoken on numerous panels, including IFP and Cannes Film Festival in France. Elise is originally from Durham, North Carolina, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and is glad to call New York City her home again. I am delighted to welcome the Future Focus Now, a fellow Ram in the house. Elise, thank you for joining us on Future Focus Now.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We are glad to have you here. I've been reading about you all day, and as chancellor of, as the students say these days, you know, the illustrious Winston-Salem State University. I am glad to have an alumna. Welcome once again to Future Focus. Tell us about how you're doing, first of all. I got to ask folks how they're doing, how you're managing during this pandemic, how's your health, and where are you now?
Yeah, no, I'm managing well. You know, I think the pandemic's been hard on a lot of us. I was in New York City in the midst of like the largest crisis. So it was like really tough. Decided to come home, drive home to Durham, North Carolina, spend time with my family throughout the holidays. And I was took all precautions, took the test where I feel like they stick your brain, but you gotta take the test and you gotta put all the precautions and limit interactions as much as possible. But yeah, so, but in this moment right now, I'm just grateful to be here. I'm grateful for my health and my life, and I'm grateful to just be on the show today.
Well, fantastic. I'm glad to have you here. I am, you know, when I read folks' bios, there are certain things that really excite me. And then one of them is that you are at the Columbia University Graduate Film Program. Please, Elise, take me from Winston-Salem State University to being where you are now. How did you get there?
Well, it was so funny. I graduated in 2008, so it was the middle of the recession. So when I graduated, you're ready for all the opportunities. I had some opportunities that were going to be set up, and I think I applied for a job in NASCAR, applied for a job at NBA, and I was like, what am I going to do with my future? And I was at a crossroad whether I wanted to pursue a career in broadcast, so broadcast journalism, sports broadcast journalism, or whether I was going to pursue a career in film. And my professor, Dr. Shelly Manigo, she was like, you need to go to grad school.
And I was you're not talking about the legendary Shelly Manigo.
Okay. So, and I was like, at a crossroads, she's like, you need to go to grad school. And a lot of people kept pushing. And I was like, well, all these opportunities just dried up. And I was like, you know what? Maybe sports broadcasting isn't the way for me to go. And, you know, like I said, the recession, and you're trying to figure out what you want to do. And I was on a juror for the River Run Film Festival, which is in Winston-Salem. And I said, you know what? Maybe I should pursue a career in, like, you know, running a film festival. This seems like a cool job. Then I searched for film studies degrees in New York City, and Columbia popped up. And I wasn't too familiar with Columbia because, you know, at Winston-Salem State, I'm already at an illustrious school. So I'm not even thinking outside of North Carolina. And I said, you know what, let me just apply. And I got in. And then I was like, oh, this is an Ivy League institution. Ooh, okay. but as soon as I stepped foot on campus, it was the same energy I felt at Winston-Salem State, of that warmth and that acceptance and that openness. And I said, okay, this is it. I'm really glad, because I was nervous. I said, from HBCU to Ivy League, what's going to be the biggest difference? And for me, it was like no difference at all. I just felt the same kind of energy of, like, you know, you enter the learn and depart to serve. So, and that's exactly what I've been doing since I left Columbia, like whether it's living in San Francisco or living in Los Angeles or back in New York, like kind of kept that same energy. And it just feels really good to be in a community, even though I miss North Carolina so much. It really is nice to be in a great community in New York.
Yeah. So you go to great exotic places. You go to the Cannes Film Festival in France. I mean, what is that like?
So when I went, I did not have a passport at first, and I had to go get a passport. It was my first time traveling out the country, the first time I went to France. And, you know, like I said, you hear about on the news or you hear about in the books and everything, but it was a life-changing event for me. And that's what really confirmed for me that I was going to pursue this career in the film industry. It really solidified, you know, and it solidified because there were so many open doors. Doors just flew open. Like, I'm getting into rooms that you would not believe. Rubbing elbows with celebrities. You're like, what? You're rubbing your eyes. You're like, wait, is that that person? Is it that person? You know, so you're seeing it and you're interacting. And then I'm realizing people are really responding to this warmth and to this like kindness and this kind of like vigor that I learned from Winston-Salem State. And I'm like, you know what? I said, this might be the place to be. So I said, okay, I got to go back. So I went back a couple years ago when I was working in film distribution to close some deals and meet new people. And I'm entering a room with every head of like every studio, film studio, you know, this, I always tease, it was like at least billions of dollars in the room. And I knew exactly how to walk in a room. I walked in the head held high, said, what's up to Will Smith? Said, what's up to Uma Thurman? Like, what? But it was just so confirming and so amazing to be in these spaces and to feel like I belong in these spaces. And when I spoke to the panel, on the panel, it was really powerful. I was able to tell my story and actually tell, like, you know, what I'm doing in the industry and how I'm trying to, like, you know, really just like revolutionize the industry by leading with diversity and leading with, like, there's innovation. There's a lot of change happening in our industry right now.
Yeah, I'm going to get into that diversity in just a moment, but categorize for me your work. I mean, tell me, how do you look at it? How do you talk about it? What is it? Categorize it for me.
Yeah. So the best way I can describe it is that I mentor emerging filmmakers for a living. You know, I'm helping them out, navigating the industry, coming up with just strategizing what steps they need to take in the industry. And then I didn't realize I was doing it the whole time because, you know, when I worked in distribution or when I worked at film festivals or film nonprofits, I thought myself every time I met a filmmaker, I'm like, okay, so here you got to meet this person, you got to talk to this person, you got to do this, you got to meet this contract. And I realized I was connecting a lot of dots for a lot of people. So I said, you know what? I think this is my call. So I've taken all the diverse experience I've had in the industry and I'm just kind of put it all together and just really focus on helping emerging filmmakers, you know, make the decisions and to kind of pivot and like to avoid the pitfalls that even I have come across. So that's kind of the best way I can describe what I do.
Okay, so when you look at your work, I mean, you go into this industry. Tell me from a demographic standpoint, the makeup of folks in this industry. I mean, I'm curious, are there many people of color? Are there women? Tell me a little bit about the industry itself.
No, absolutely. I always say that most of the people who are determining what you're seeing on Netflix right now, what you're seeing on Amazon Prime, Hulu, all these platforms don't really look like us. You know, some of them are my friends, we're cool, but like the majority of them are white, cisgendered, heterosexual men who with MBAs from Harvard. So that's a vast majority of the people. And about 2 years ago, I kind of brought attention to this. I was featured in an article in The Wrap talking about the lack of diversity. And I said, hey, this is a real problem. We're not having... I realized it was a problem specifically, not just in front of the screens and actors or just the directors, not just the people greenlighting, but the people who are determining the things that you're seeing. There's a lot of Black content out there. There's a lot of content from Latinx directors. There's a lot of content from Indigenous people and from women and from many people with diverse backgrounds. where they're not getting to the point of distribution, where they're actually not only making money, but finding their audiences. And I think it is with those decision makers, the acquisitions executives, the content acquisitions managers who work at these major streaming platforms that I think are some of the issues where they're like, I don't know if it's the right fit, or we don't have the target demo, or we just don't know how to reach these audiences. And these are actual phrases that industry executives have told me about specifically Black content, but it was just like content from people in general and from people of color in general. So yeah, it's the breakdown of people working in the industry in terms of the really decision makers is not diverse at all. But we do have diversity when it comes to the filmmakers and people creating these stories. It's just getting to that point of reaching audience members.
Yeah, Lee, this is what I'm interested in. And I'm interested in, one, the work that you do in getting more Black and brown women into the industry. But I'm also interested in your view as to whether indeed they are transforming the industry the more folks we get into this. Let me preface this with, is 2020 and in the mid 90s, August Wilson was invited to come up to Princeton University. So, you know, August is there and he's talking to primarily a white audience, and he's literally chastising them because he says, you know, you really don't want Black artists and Black actors. I mean, you want them to fit into your mode. You don't want us to come into this space and be genuine and authentic. I'm wondering if, as you look at the work that you do and what you're seeing, are we getting true transformation and true authenticity in terms of African-Americans, Latinx folks, women in general?
Yeah, so what I'm seeing is, like I said before, there is a amazing well of like amazing talented people, and just having those issues getting seen. So I think it has shifted and has changed. You look at, you know, Barry Jenkins, you know, someone who had a small indie project, I think it was $18,000 for his first feature, but then it takes him how long to make a movie like Moonlight, and for Moonlight to single-handedly change how the independent, specifically the independent film world runs, basically. And you look at someone like Jordan Peele, you know, who's kind of was a cultural reset with Get Out, you know, redefined, you know, those genre content. So I think that there's changes happening, and like we have been at the forefront of these changes, but we had to kind of create our own space for this. And one thing that I actually appreciate is social media. What I'm starting to see with more and more social media is not just like this whole idea of cancel culture, but this idea of like there's a connectivity that's happening that wasn't happening before. We're finding each other, you know, so saying like, wait, you talked to this executive and he told you the same thing. Oh, no, let's call out. And I think what happened during the summertime, you see the open letters of like industry executive of the Black industry executives and the industry executives of color who are saying like, hey, we're not going to do this anymore. It's time for us to stand up and actually like open the floodgates for these filmmakers. And we saw that happening mainly on Twitter, saying like, you know what, we were too afraid to say that, you know, we'll call out people or anything like this, but also harkens back to Me Too, hashtag Me Too. And then with the movement this summer, we're like, hey, let's call them out on Twitter. Let's call them out on Facebook and Instagram. You know, we're not going to take it anymore. So there's been a community of independent filmmakers who are single-handedly changing the culture.
All right. Well, talk a little bit more about that. I'm interested in the independent filmmakers, really some of the issues or the struggles that they have in order to getting their products out. Is the industry now all of a sudden just more open and receptive to these, or are folks forcing their way in?
We have to force our way. and also we have to be careful of the lip service that people are giving. They hire, you know, diversity and inclusion executives at the same time, but at the same time, they're not still, that's all they're doing. And then they have to shoulder all the responsibility of saying like, hey, you're the head of diversity and inclusion for like WarnerMedia, this specific thing, and like, you're going to solve all our problems. So it's putting some of these people in unfair positions. And so they have to be responsible for making sure they're meeting mandates at the companies. But at the same time, you're still missing a lot of people. You know, the industry, even if you have more and more diversity, it's about kind of still being more involved, you know, which is why I try to introduce as many like mentorship initiatives as I possibly can, so that they're not completely like, oh, I'm just at the tippy top and I'm losing touch with like the people who are on the ground, the next Jordan Peele or the next Barry Jenkins. So they're not like missing those opportunities. So it's a slow and steady, but yeah. I've also seen as more support for, you know, specifically for very specific festivals, like, you know, like in organizations like the Black Film Space or Black Star Film Festival or other festivals that are really, like Indie Memphis is another one. And this is in Philadelphia and Memphis, not all in New York and LA, but we're trying to find places where we are appreciated and our work is valued.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what is the current thinking or status that's associated with independent filmmaking today? What are some of the things that you are seeing and some of the areas that people are going into now that may be different than 5 years ago or when you first got in the business?
Yeah, so previously we saw films that were all about like, you know, the struggle, or we have your slave movies, then you have your hood narratives is what I call them, and then you have the stories about like police brutality. And that was pretty much it. I remember being on a call with the executive from BET who was not Black. And I remember him telling me, oh, no, all our audiences wants to see is like a white version of a Black film, or a Black version of a white film. That's all they want to see. And I was like, well, I'm actually your target demographic, and that's not what I want to see. I want to see original stories. But they're like, no. One thing I love to say is the film industry is dumb and lazy. They don't.
Wait, what do you say? Why do you say that?
They don't want to do the work. They're like, let's make money. Okay, then let's do that. That's all they want to do. So it's a huge push and to get original stories. But we're starting to now see more original stories because of this, and because we found other ways to getting our content seen. Like there's other platforms. Quelle TV is one platform that's specifically for films from the African diaspora. You know, and there's other tiny platforms and places that are trying. We're trying to find our own way of getting our stories seen. And also, what I always speak about is finding your audience, you know? So, you know, independent filmmakers have to be DIY filmmakers. They have to be entrepreneurial. So you can't just be an artist in a bubble. You can't exist in a bubble being an independent filmmaker. You have to be original. You have to think outside the box. You have to think about like, how do I find my audience? How do I connect with them? It takes a lot of work, but once you connect that audience, you know, and one thing I will say specifically about people of color, when we are dedicated to supporting artists, we are dedicated and we show with our dollars. It's just that some of the industry just doesn't want to do the work.
Yeah. And you mentioned the multiple platforms out there now, new platforms springing up every day. What are some of the platforms that you're seeing now that you think will last and are sustainable? Because I know, you know, people come and go, and you can say, well, that is a medium that's going to take off. Have you got your eyes on a couple?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, there's a reason why Netflix works. You know, Netflix was, they basically single-handedly changed the industry because most of the industry was operating like the old studio system, you know, but Netflix comes and operates like a tech company and working in the film industry. And that changed how all of us thought about streaming. So now, like, you know, Netflix is a household name, but just like 5 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, Netflix was not a household name. People didn't really know Netflix it is today. And they started introducing original content. That's why Netflix is so good, and they are valued at billions of dollars without making billions of dollars, because of their original content and that we are watching, and they know exactly what we're watching. So they set the standard very high. I worked for a small streaming platform called Fandor, which is now defunct, but it was focused on like more original content, a lot of like not original content, but you know, like independent content and like more obscure things that you will normally see on other platforms. And what we saw is that, you know, people like the notes of discovery, you know, that Netflix wasn't offering. So in terms of streaming platforms that are offering those kind of discovery, it's going to be really hard to find because it's all algorithmic based. It's all based on like your viewing habits. So if you like this, you'll probably like that. That's what you probably watch something on Netflix and you're like, it has all the elements that I'm looking for, but something missing. There's a little je ne sais quoi that's missing, you know what I'm saying? But in terms of platforms that I do like, you know, I like Mubi, M-U-B-I. It's only like 30 days of like a certain amount of movies and they rotate out every 30 days with new movies. So it promotes like this kind of discovery on the platform. And they really kind of stepped up their game in offering more content, more independent content from people of color and from women and people with disabilities and queer individuals. So, so Mubi is a great one. The Criterion Collection is always a good one. You know, I'm an indie person. I love my independent films. So, you know, and then there's also independent films on Hulu that tend to get like in the recent discoveries or hidden gems. So I can, anybody who's listening in, go look at the hidden gems category, find an independent film, seek it out, buy or rent it on Amazon or Apple TV. So find an opportunity to support, you're supporting these local, you're supporting filmmakers who look just like us.
See, now you got me interested. You're gonna have me going back looking at independent films. I appreciate that. Talk a little bit about, Elise, the ability for a filmmaker or actor in today's world to really monetize who they are. I mean, I look at the history, you know, of particularly African-Americans in this industry, and they become superstars, and then they'll make, you know, some film about them, and I'll find out that they didn't monetize it well. They didn't get a lot of money out of it. I even listened the other day to Dave Chappelle talking about how HBO Max was all of a sudden, you know, ripping him off, streaming his stuff. What's going on in that thinking about how folks can do that better?
Well, how much more time do we have? Because it's a whole but it's meant to be difficult. That's what I encourage any filmmaker I mentor. It is a system that's not built for you to make money. And this was the biggest challenge in distribution, is that it's not built to make money. It's built to make these companies money. That's how it's structured. That's how, when you look at a distribution contract, it's always in favor of the distribution company making the max amount of money they can possibly make. So there's a lot of like amazing films that will never see the light of day because they got bad distribution deals and they weren't able to monetize their films, and they're just sitting on hard drives. So it happens, and it still happens to this day. There have been companies that have tried to solve this problem that have also gone under because they've been so focused on their own self-interest. So in terms of like monetizing, it's extremely difficult, but to my old standby is knowing your audience. You know, if you know your audience, your audience will spend money on your film. So that's why I really do encourage for certain films to self-distribute. So you're kind of getting rid of the middleman for the most part. You still need to utilize a middleman to kind of get your films on certain platforms. But if you can go directly or find a direct way for people to support your film, that is the best way to monetize your film and keep as much money as possible. Not saying you're making millions and millions of dollars. You know, Mary Jane is just now making millions, but he wasn't for a very long time. So it takes a while to, and you know these names because they've worked so hard for you to know their names. You know, they've had to sacrifice. They've had to sell their souls. You know, Barry Jenkins made his first film, Medicine for Melancholy, for $18,000. Almost 10 years later, he made Moonlight.
Now he has lots of money, right? Now he has
much, but made for at least, I don't know the exact budget, but I know it's at least $1 million.
Right.
You know, so it's that 18,000 to million, 10 years, just to give you, and that's rare, if you even get a chance to do that. So it's not just talent that alone will monetize and just money will come out the sky for film. It's a very difficult industry, you know, but it can also is the most lucrative industry for filmmakers. And there's no one way of doing it. There's no one path to kind of like monetize. Like, you know, that's what I say. If someone says, I've done this exact same thing for somebody else, I'm gonna do it for you, run the other way because they're gonna take all your money.
Hey, give me a couple, one thing that you're proud of in terms of your work, and quickly, what's next for you?
Yeah, so one thing I'm proud of, there's a lot. I'm really proud of my students. They're from around the world, you know, from Beijing to Mexico to London to South Africa. Like, they're from all over, and I appreciate them. And I really, I'm really proud of them because they've been able to kind of pivot and understand and be adaptable during this huge time in our industry, you know. So I'm really proud of them for that. And what's next for me, you know, I speak a lot of panels about this very subject. You know, I'm trying to kind of conceptualize what's happening in the industry and how to prepare for the major shifts that are going to happen in the industry. There's a new normal and how we're going to watch content. We're not going to be going to movie theaters like we used to. We're going to be streaming more and more and more. So how do you adapt? So I'm doing a lot of speaking about this very topic. I'm maybe do some writing about this very topic because it's literally at the top of everyone's mind. So that's the main thing that's next for me.
Fantastic. And you grew up in Durham?
Yes, I did.
You grew up in Durham. So I was in Durham probably when you were born, and then I was at North Carolina Central. Where did you go to high school?
I went to Jordan High School.
Went to Jordan High School. I know it well. I know Jordan High School well. Now you're back in Durham. This is holiday season, Thanksgiving. Tell us something. What are you thankful for as you go into this holiday season?
Number one thing I'm thankful for is family. You know, like I said, I lived in San Francisco for a while, 3,000 miles away from my family. And I think there were only, you know, three of us out there. And I didn't know anybody. And it was a very isolating experience. You know, I love San Francisco, you know, but being back on the East Coast, being back in New York, and coming and being able to come home via car without getting on a plane safely. In this moment, I am extremely grateful to be close physically to my family right now and safely. That's the number one thing I'm grateful for.
Well, you know, I wish you well. I wish you good health. I also want to extend an invitation for you to come to Winston-Salem State University and talk to the students and tell them about how to do what you do. Right?
Of course.
All right. Yeah. So thank you so much. You've been a great guest. We'll get you back at some point. So thank you for coming on Future Focus Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good enough. Thank you, everybody. Once again, what a great show tonight. And we thank both of our guests tonight. And please come back again next week for another edition of Future Focus Now.